Hello there. My name is Evan Dvorak, and you are listening to Conservation Connections here on WDRT. Today, I am talking with Tom Lukens, and we are going to be chatting about, well, we'll see where the conversation goes, but in general, we're going to be talking about native plantings, Tom's life of, you know, instituting conservation stuff on his property in the West Fork of the Kickapoo, and we'll just see where the conversation goes from there. So, welcome, Tom.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I look forward to spreading the word about conservation easements and habitat for wildlife.
There we go. All right. Well, let's start out with, why don't you just talk a little bit about your background? What brought you to the Kickapoo Valley?
Yeah, well, I'm a Midwest kid. I went to college at St. Olaf in Northfield, Minnesota, and my first trip to the Driftless area, to this area, was in 1969. As a freshman in college, and but I ended up having a career in the Monterey Bay in horticulture, where we bred and produced flower bulbs of certain species and sold them around the world. And but I bought this property about 23 years ago on the West Fork, 87 acres with a mile of the West Fork running through it, and been in hog heaven ever since.
Yeah, what is it specifically that brought you to that property?
Well, I fell in love with the Driftless. You know, we're in such a unique geology with spring-fed cold water streams. You know, it wasn't hard to fall in love with. And I was never a West Coast guy. Brown winters and or brown summers and green winters wasn't what I was born with. But this area, I took a walk of this property. I put up some ducks and geese. I saw trout in the stream, turtles swimming by, and I was sold. I actually shopped for property one half of one day. So I just pulled the trigger and never looked back.
All right. Yeah, I mean, the Kickapoo is such a unique environment here in the upper Midwest. I can understand that. So what did that property look like when you first stepped onto it? Does it look completely different now? I mean,
it sure does. Yeah. It was being farmed, had been farmed for a long time. They ran cattle on it through the woods and into the wetland. But it was being farmed organically at the time, which was good for me because, organic land queued up higher in the Natural Resource Conservation Service Farm Bill EQIP dollar potentials to get some cost share. So, but yeah, it was pretty degraded stuff. It's got 8 feet of sediments in the whole valley there. So we started out. I was familiar with the NRCS and went in asking questions within a month of having bought it, and within a year I had $34,000 worth of EQIP contracts signed up, of which I only had to pay 35%, because conservation for the protection of keeping sediments going into the system, and creating trout habitat was part of the deal. But I went in saying I'd like to do non-game work, put in the first turtle hibernaculas, the first snake hibernacula, first turtle basking logs, created some wetlands. So I kind of went in thinking that the most wildlife possible was what I wanted.
Right. So, I mean, there's obviously a lot of programs out there. I think landowners can get kind of overwhelmed with how to access that whole system, because there is a lot of federal and state and sometimes county dollars that are available. But how did you start to navigate that? Did you have a background in that, or did the local staff help you out with that?
The Resource Conservation District in Monterey Bay, that I served on the board on, gave me familiarity. But the thing is that a lot of those programs are farm bill dollars. And so when people move in and buy a piece of property and get the idea that they really don't want somebody farming anymore, sometimes that works against you. You need to, you know, you can say, look, give me a buffer here, give me a grass waterway. You can ask for some conservation steps to be implemented in your land lease, but kicking the farmer off shuts the door on probably 70% of the funding opportunities. So it's important to work with them with sustainable land leases or whatever, and keep them keep them on the property so you can get access to farm bill dollars. Yeah.
And we do have a lot of, we're lucky that we have a lot of really conscientious farmers in our area. So if you are a landowner and looking, you know, to boost the conservation value or keep the soil in place on your property, there's definitely a network of people to access here in the area.
Our office, the NRCS office, writes more contracts than most other offices in the state because there are a lot of interested people here, fortunately.
Right. Well, okay, so you start doing work on your property from day one, right, when you move in there. So what's the first big project that you instituted there?
First thing I wanted to do was transition off of some of the corn ground. So we took the piece that was the biggest pain in the neck for the guy to farm, Little Triangle, and planted prairie on it right off. And that I did without NRCS funding. I didn't even realize there was money available for that. So that was just a personal deal. But we, you know, you put down the weed seed by tilling and 18 months of fallow, and then and sowed prairie, and I donated money to some local prairie clubs and got to spike my seed mix, and then bought local seed, and so we planted, I think it was about a 4 or 5 acre piece of prairie within the first 2 years, and then at the end of the second year we also started all that stream bank work with the snake and turtle hibernacula and basking logs and all that stuff.
And those prairie plantings, those initial prairie plantings, they subsisted? And how does a prairie planting look after, you know, we're talking 20 years now?
Yeah, nearly
like
20
after
years.
After planting, yeah. So has it kind of regenerated itself? It keeps going on its own? Or?
Yes. There's an adage in establishing prairie that the first year it sleeps, second year it creeps, and third year it leaps. You got to be really patient when you plant prairie. And I tell people that planting prairie is a bit like painting a house. Most of the work's in scraping and sanding and taping and doing all that prep work. So exhausting the seed bed of the unwanted is most important. So, like I say, with tillage, with spot spraying, with cover crops, you can do any number of things to exhaust that. But 18 months of fallow, and when the weeds come up, you go out and turn that over. And by the third year, then you really see quite a lot of bloom. But it changes still every year. So at this point, we burn it every 3 to 5 years on rotation and never burn all of it at once. Since then, we've also planted another 8 acres of prairie. So we got several different fire sections that we can rotate. And we put the trails in to act as fire break, so we're not having to do extra work come fire break time. And yeah, with planting, it's pretty easy to burn every 3 to 5 years in a reasonable pattern. I need a map to help me remember what's what, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what is it about native prairie that is such a valuable conservation tool here in our area? Because historically, we had a lot, this region had a lot of prairie.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, they prairie rivals rainforests and wetlands for biodiversity. That old cornfield, even though it was organic, you know, we'd have 3 or 4 bird species come through and some pollinators, but not many. And now, you know, it's 15, 20 different bird species, lots of mammals, snakes, frogs and toads. So it's just, it's rewarding beyond what I'd imagined. I didn't know anything about prairie when I started. Yeah, I worked in horticulture, but prairie is different. And so all you got to do is just be humble enough to ask people who know more than you do questions. Take some notes and follow their directions. That's all I did. Yeah.
Right. And this was marginal crop ground that sounds like now it's a pretty fertile place.
Yeah, it was valley ground, so it was pretty fertile. It could the lower portion could be subjected to floodwaters, but it was decent ground. We did soil tests and went to find out that the stuff up by the county S where we are was so heavy in phosphorus that they couldn't recommend a 7-year rotation to get rid of it because it was the old tobacco field. Every bit of manure that ever was went on that field, and so it was just really, really high in phosphorus. So, yeah, there are all kinds of resources like that. State Historical Society will give you pictures back from the 30s what your property looked like. They can get aerial photos of them. And so, yeah, there's a lot of interesting history to be turned over. And, yeah, it was certainly looked a lot different then than it does now. Since that time, you know, it was value enough to qualify a valuable habitat to qualify to with Mississippi Valley Conservancy to put a conservation easement on the property. So, yeah, that's been fun too.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you mentioned you did some stream bank restoration. So yeah. You're on the West Fork of the Kickapoo, which, you know, nowadays is a pretty famous stretch of water for trout fishermen.
Yeah.
But you know, it sounds like you're not just managing that stretch of river for trout. It's, you know, it's a bigger ecosystem, just that one.
Yeah, I kind of gave the NRCS guys a hard time and said that, you know, if you're only thinking about trout, you're just monocropping corn. You know, we need to think more broadly than that. So, yeah, I got some of the first non-game habitat funding that WIP money, wildlife habitat improvement money, with EQIP money, with you know, we even got a little bit of Ho-Chunk money to help build a wetland, a constructed wetland. So, yeah, but I kind of just, snakes and turtles and frogs always turned me on, and if I could help do more for them, birds, of course, as well. So it was just kind of a natural. So we created a Nature Nooks retreat, a little three cabin facility on this mile of the West Fork. And I love turning kids on. You know, kid that catches his first crawdad or turtle, and if you don't start early, you don't care about it later. So that too has been fun.
Well, let's, you know, we can talk a little bit more about the non-game habitat that you've been constructing there on the property. So you mentioned the snake hibernacula.
Yeah.
What does that look like, and what kind of species live in that?
Yeah. There are several, or half a dozen species of snake, all non-poisonous, that actually overwinter underwater.
So really?
So you dig a cloth, it's basically a great big cloth-lined rock pit, two-thirds of which is underwater, and then it has this open head space. So it's a cloth line fabric, geotextile fabric, all this rock in it, and you fold that fabric back up over top of it, fill it with over top of it with 5-6 feet of dirt, and then we gave a little chute that goes out to the south side with some big basking rocks there, so the snakes could, you know, they go down there and spend the winter and then come out in the summer. Really hard to monitor though. You can find some snake skins, but, you know, a motion detector camera will get thousands of pictures of a blade of grass going by. And so it's hard to monitor. But, you know, I certainly have seen far more snake species now. And like I say, all non-poisonous. And, yeah.
Right. Cool. And you also mentioned turtle nest boxes. So what does that look like?
Yeah, that's the project that I'm doing right now. I went to a Natural Resource Foundation field day last year and saw somebody who'd for 30, going on 40 years, had a nest box where he was encouraging wood turtles, which is a threatened species. And so I came back, and right now we got the skid steer there. We're excavating a 2-foot deep, 20 by 30 foot place in the prairie, and we'll build a 2-foot-tall chicken wire cage, wood frame chicken wire cage, and with a small gap at the bottom for the turtles to get in, and that the skunks and raccoons can't get in. So they go in there and they lay starting mid-May through June, and 75, 90 days later, the hatchlings are coming out, and we've had successful nesting in this area before, so I figured it was a good place to put the thing.
Yeah, and do you know, do the turtles return to the same place every year to
lay
their eggs?
They do, and it's
eggs?
Been said that sometimes it's hard to get them to come to a new place. They might even walk by a suitable place to get to what they're used to. But, you know, if you look at the photos from back in the 30s, it was a big sand wash down the bottom of the West Fork. The turtles were probably one of the species that did well by all that erosive, all that sand deposition. But more recently, the floodings have just put down silt, and we're getting a little heavier soil. Heavier soil is okay for snappers and painted turtles, but wood turtles like pure sand and the soft shells like sand. So we're trying to make it suitable for all five of the species of turtles that we have found on the place.
Right. And what else have you put into place for the turtle habitat? I think you mentioned before when we were talking logs.
The turtles like to bask. It's good for hardening their shells. It helps dry the leeches off of them. And as a kid, we were always creeping around the corner to see if there were turtles up on the log or the big rock at the edge of the stream or pond. And so we put in several turtle basking logs that are basically at water level in the stream and in little eddies, so it's not fast moving water. So they just climb up on them and bask. And then we've made some very shallow bank slopes for things like the soft shells that are really shy and don't like to get more than about 20 feet away from the water if they can help it. So we've saw turtles there to begin. It was one of the things that sold me on the property, and so I just figured it's to me to give them a little more acceptable habitat. Yeah.
What about beavers? I know that can be a controversial issue in our area, but I mean, I think you're probably a fairly pro beaver guy. I'm just going to take a guess.
When I first bought the property, there were times that I could, in one binocular view, I could see a half a dozen beaver at a given time. And then they would move on. And I asked a local biologist, what was going on there. He said, you'll find that they move. They'll come in and then they'll move and they'll come back 3 to 5 years. And that's what it is. They're just kind of on a cycle. They're like the rotational grazers. They nip a little willow, eat all that cambium, all that bark. And once they have taken the food out of a given area, they'll move on to someplace else. But when they come back 3 years later, that one sprout has become 3 to 5 sprouts. They're just multiplying their food source. So they're back again at our place now. And beaver dam analogs, man-made beaver dams. There are several associations that advise you on how to do those things. And you know, as a big kid old man, it's fun to go play in the mud and with sticks and mud and see it change. I think it's most rewarding half a day's work I've ever done is putting in a channel spanning log structure or something and see the water back up behind it. And before the end of the year, you got minnows and turtles in what had been reed canary and poison parsnip. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, what is a beaver dam analog?
A beaver dam analog is a man-made beaver dam that you make by driving posts in the ground and then weaving branches back and forth through these posts, and you do it in 4-inch rises. So you put in 4 or 6 inches of these woven in willow branches, and then you pack it with mud, and you go it again, do it again, and just like beaver do. A beaver dam analog, and they told me that if I built these things, the chances are the beaver would be invited back in, because they need to have water to feel safe. So you back up a little water, and if there's food around, they'll come in. And I know beaver can be controversial in terms of some folks and trout and all, but beaver and trout co-evolved. You can't tell me that beaver are bad for trout. They co-evolved. Yes, I understand they can be an impediment for some migration when it comes time for laying eggs and all, but they do make it through those things, and they actually reduce the water temperature by building up water behind them, then it infiltrates into the ground. Two-thirds of the water in any, no, three times the amount of water is underground than is in the pond. 3 to 5 times more water underneath there. So you're actually improving water infiltration and having it come out as spring someplace else and keeping the water temperatures down, actually. So, you know, and there's a, the, it's called, process-based restoration of riverscapes, and the Utah State University's Conservation Consortium. If you just look those things up, they got a great little handbook. Shows you how to make these things, what they do, and that's what I've used for my design plans.
Yeah, I mean, I just know anecdotally in my little valley, since the beaver have moved in, I've noticed that the flooding has basically stopped. I mean, when we had that huge rain, I think 4 inches of rain, I went down and then looked at that creek, and it looked like the same flow downstream of the dam that as it always does. So it really does. It slows the water. It's able to charge it into the soil and slowly release it over time. Which
They slow down. Yeah, the rule is in this consortium's view is to slow down and make more complex surface water flow. That's what beavers do, and so they do provide flood buffer, and they act like sponges when the water comes. They soak it up. They don't send it downstream at high velocities in a channelized way, and they also move. They change. It's not like a permanent structure, or you're putting in a bunch of riprap or concrete or something. They spread and slow the water, and that's what we need for flood mitigation.
Right. Absolutely. Well, what about trees? Have you planted a lot of trees on your property?
Yes, I'm a fan of Douglas Ptolemy. He's an entomologist who's kind of coined the plant natives for biodiversity, and the America's Homegrown National Park has kind of sprung out of his work. Bringing Nature Home or Nature's Best Hope or a couple of his really good books. So, there's a website that tells you what is native to your area and how much diversity it supports as indexed against how many moth and butterfly species it supports. So in our area, oaks are the keystone tree species. In our zip code, so you go to NWF or you go to nativeplantfinder.nwf.org, put in your zip code, and if you're looking for trees, it'll rank the trees by how much they support. If you're looking for shrubs, it'll do the same. Same thing for herbaceous plants. So it's oaks are number one in our area, followed by willows and the prunus, the cherry family. That's what I've planted the most of is oaks, willows, and cherries. When it comes to the prairie, it's asters, sunflowers, and goldenrods are the primary. I've tried to prioritize plantings based on what supports the most diversity.
Right, and these trees actually are extremely. I mean, they host a ton of species.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. An oak in our zip code is said to support 534 different species of Lepidoptera. So, and why is that important? Well, a single chickadee feeds its brood of young between 7,000 and 9,000 caterpillars just to fledge that brood. So you need species that support the locally co-evolved Lepidoptera in order to support the neotropical and other birds that come to the area. So right on down the line, tried to rank things by how much they support and then plant those more than anything else.
All right. Are there any other projects you want to talk about that you've instituted? You have a business. You're running a business off of that property too.
Yeah, we have Nature Nooks Retreat that is a little three cabin facility where we have kayaks and there's swimming and fishing and stuff. But it has a charter, has a mission, which is to protect and enhance biodiversity and caring capacity, and create a means of sharing a sense of awe, connection, and caring. And as a guy who kind of needs to have some purpose, it's given me focus for my habitat efforts and the rest of it. So, and it's really if kids don't get turned on early, they don't care later. I don't know, if they're just at home playing thumb junkie on their phones or something, they need to get out and catch their first turtle or snake and be impressed. They say that the most important thing about environmental education is to instill a sense of awe. If they're going, wow, you're getting in there. So that's what we try to do with Nature Nooks Retreat.
All right. And so, you've obviously put a lot of work into this property, and you don't want to see all that work you know, when you decide to either, if you sell the property or you pass it on, you don't want that work to be erased when you're gone. You don't want that land to be developed. And you found a way to protect that work, right?
Yes. We have a conservation easement with Mississippi Valley Conservancy. And that is, those are basically, you agree to restrictions on the deed. So nobody can come into that, the 87 acres, and chop it up and put several houses on it with river frontage. It has to stay intact. Nor can they mine it or commercially log it or build down in areas that have the high conservation value. So I'm on the board of Mississippi Valley Conservancy, and I think it's a great organization. It's already protected 7,000 acres in our area.
And so, has MVC done most of that protection through easements or outright purchase of property?
In some cases, they get property. They do purchase property. A lot of it's easements, but anything they purchase, there's public access on 5,000 of these acres. If they're Mississippi Valley Conservancy, you can go to their website and see Tunnelville property. Oh, those are held by MVC, and they got paths and public access. So it's a way of giving, of ensuring that public access is still available to people, and as long as state legislature passes Knowles Nelson someday.
Oh, okay. Well, if somebody is interested in doing a conservation easement, I mean, what's the first step you have to take to go down that path?
Well, you can get in touch with Mississippi Valley Conservancy. It is true that they want to see recognized conservation value on the property. So they want to see that, you know, it's not just 50 acres of overgrown honeysuckle or barberry or something. So we're in the riparian corridor. So, yes, we ranked well when they came and did a survey. Matter of fact, at the time, we set the species record for a single property in a two-hour overview. I think they've since had somebody pass it up. But anyway, conservation easements, if you got some place that you really would like to protect your efforts, I'm just all for it and be happy to talk to anybody about it anytime.
All right. Well, you folks might have an opportunity to talk to you about this in person if they'd like. Here at the end of July, July 23rd, there's a workshop coming up at your place, right?
Yeah, it's creative approaches to habitat diversity through Mississippi Valley Conservancy, through their Link to the Land series. And I think you can, like you say, it's July 23rd, just a 6 to 8 p.m. And you can register 5 weeks in advance of the workshop through the Mississippi Valley Conservancy website. They do a lot of good workshops with a lot of knowledgeable people. So we'll be doing that, and it's fun. I get to walk people around and motor mouth about things I love. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So what can people expect to do at that workshop?
Well, we've got all these native plantings that you know, where you're creating outdoor rooms with native shrubs and trees and all. We'll see the beaver dam analogs. We'll see the constructed wetland, the nest box, there'll be several will be a tour with probably 15, 20 different little spots to stop and talk about what's going on.
All right. Well, to repeat, that workshop will be July 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m. at Nature Nooks. So go on the Mississippi Valley Conservancy website if you want to get more information for that, and pre-register ahead of time. And otherwise, today I've been talking with Tom Lukens. Thanks, Tom, so much for coming on Conservation Connections.
You're most welcome.